Welcome to Rumike Talks podcast. I'm your host, Konstantin Starodetsky. This is a space where I interview professionals from the entertainment industry and discuss popular film-related topics with my co-host
and producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. Our goal is to help and motivate aspiring filmmakers to get their films made.
Enjoy. I'm thrilled to interview Matthew Sprosti. Matthew is a screenwriter, playwright, and novelist from Bay Village, Ohio. In this conversation, Matthew tells an incredible details behind the last story of David Allen's screenplay, shares his early days of writing, and announces the title of his next book, a sequel to The Dead Life. Please welcome Matthew Sprosti. All right, welcome to the Rumike Talks, and today we have Matthew Sprosti. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
I've been trying to get you to this interview for quite some time because when we were taking UCLA class together, I really enjoyed just talking to you. It was so easy. The feedback that you were getting for screenplays was amazing. And I always appreciated the talent that you have. And I wanted to know more about you, but I really didn't have time because I had to write my own scripts back then. But now I do. So let's talk about you. Where did it all start? Where does writing gene appeared in you? Where did you decide that, okay, so maybe I'll try to do it professionally or try to do it for the sake of it?
I use writing really to communicate at all. I remember that in fifth grade, I was moved to a different city and I didn't know anybody in my class. And at the exact same time, it was kind of fortuitous that they were doing a young author's assembly or whatnot, where they were saying, everybody write a short story. It will be put into the local library. And at that time, I found a way to communicate without having to talk to anybody around me. And so I sat there and I wrote. Another girl was a new girl, and so I wrote like a horror story. I wrote a story about how she was a demon, and we all my imaginary friends that were real people around at the classes around, or at the desks around my desk, were going to band up and get rid of her, or whatever, or save her. I forget how that story ends. But it ended up being like everybody wrote kind of like two-page stories, and mine ended up being like 32 pages as a 10-year-old. And so when I submitted it, everybody got the same award. Nobody, you know, sung my graces or whatnot, but they're like, you obviously have a lot to say. After that, I realized that if I put real people, if I put my real classmates into my stories, everybody wanted to read them. And so I put the popular kids into my stories. And so suddenly, like, come like seventh and eighth grade when we're all playing football or whatnot, the football team is reading the stories and they're saying, hey, can you have me dating this celebrity? And so suddenly, like, the captain of the football team is dating Sharon Stone in my stories, and everybody is getting such a kick out of it, you know? So moving forward, now I found my audience. And then in high school, I joined drama club, and I start getting into theater and writing, and realizing at the same time that I enjoy when actual professionals are reading my scripts out loud. And at the same time, I decided to write another horror screenplay, which is I wrote about Jack the Ripper. And the research portion of that, to research the murder scenes. This, granted, I'm a freshman in high school, so I'm probably a little disturbed 13-year-old who's getting into all these like 1888 English murder mysteries and everything and trying to like figure out the clues myself. But I then write my murder scenes in express detail to what actually happened. And I realized that I love the research portion of script writing. Get to college, I write a play with one of my buddies for a 10-minute undergraduate playwriting festival, because that was our task at the time, freshman year. And they canceled it because there was not enough time in the graduate playwriting festival. And so we did guerrilla work. We didn't break any locks or whatnot, but we knew when the theater building wasn't going to be occupied. And so we set up our own chairs, we handed out flyers, and we told everybody, we're going to have the readings of our plays, regardless whether the school wants to sanction it or not. We do that. One of the grad playwrights named Queen Aguin, who has found phenomenal success right now writing for, he did Raya and the Last Dragon, was one of his movies that he just wrote that came out. awesome guy, and he was in the audience for us, and he was like, you know what, if the school doesn't want it, he's like, I want to help you guys put up your own play productions. And so sophomore year, that's what he does. He lets us, he kind of mentors us to all put up our undergraduate plays, all of our 10 minutes. And now we're hungry. Me and this other guy named Jeff Rosenberg, who also has had success out in Hollywood. He did OJ the Musical, was probably my favorite title because it is about Orenthal James Simpson's Bronco Chase all set to music and stuff like that. So if anybody wants to find that, him and I write full lengths and we get those produced. And by now the school has sanctioned us to do it. I think it's the first time in Ohio University that undergraduates got full length production sanctioned by the university to put them up. And we do it and we sell out. We break fire codes. There's too many people in the audience. It's amazing. Everybody's supporting it. We get to cast our friends because they're so young. They don't get to be on the main stage productions yet because that's going to the senior and juniors. And now it's like all hands on deck. I'm writing every single night. I'm just doing play after play, not producing them, but getting readings done until senior year when one of my plays also has a reading down in Atlanta. And then when we graduate college, a bunch of the actors are like, we want to start a theater production company up in Cleveland. Will you come with us, be a resident playwright? And I was like, oh my gosh, direction. You know, like we're all looking for direction in our life. I was like, absolutely, I'm going to go home. I'm going to take over the family's business, which was a manufacturer of paper potato bags. and then I will have my own theater company, and this is going to be great. And so we do it. Theater doesn't make a whole lot of money. It all starts closing down. Like, I'm the statutory agent, as long resident playwright and managing director. Everybody splits. I'm left with like a $42,000 purse and a bunch of actors to pay off and whatnot. And at the same time, I write a short story in my MySpace blog back in MySpace days. And it was a story about an assassin falling in love with a girl, but he was forced into being a killer and everything. And one person in the theater company was like, hey, if you could turn that into screenplay, we could do that. And I was like, awesome direction. So I do it in a weekend. He is working on a movie in Pittsburgh with a guy named Robert Ruggeri, a producer behind films like Take Shelter and Kings of Summer. And he reads it as a favor to my friend. And he's like, okay, I'll read the script, like thinking nothing of it because everybody in the industry gets so many scripts a day, loves it, wants to direct it, comes up to Cleveland to meet me. And suddenly we're like off to the races. And so I begin to option that script to him. And that takes me through a bunch of steps. Worst thing that could possibly happen. Everybody says your first script, you're not going to sell it. You're not going to option it. I ended up selling and optioning a rough draft of a script that I wrote over the weekend, which was pretty much, I wrote things in high school. Didn't do any research, have no idea how good they are, but this one sells, right? So the reason why it was the worst thing is suddenly I think I'm a genius. And I'm like, and the big break has come and everything is going to work out. And yes, the paper potato bag manufacturing went down because everybody went to plastic and decided to destroy the world. And then also the theater company went down because theater doesn't make money and we had no idea what we were doing. But I sold a script, and now I'm going to be rich and famous, and everything's going to work out. Fast forward to me sitting here with you. That script is now set for production on September 1st. It's probably its 30th, you know, set for production date. I could tell you so much about how the script is cursed. Like, maybe if we just get the curse out there in the world. Mm-hmm. The first guy that was going to finance the script was a recording artist named Emin. Have you ever heard of Emin?
Emin, no.
Okay. So Emin, he was trying to break into the entertainment industry by covering Elvis Presley songs. Mm. His father is the prime minister of Georgia. And so when he was first trying to finance it, suddenly he was like, I can't do this anymore because suddenly Georgia and Russia were getting into a skirmish back in the day. This is like 2009, I think. So he drops out and goes back home. And then the second guy that was going to finance it was in Egypt. Oh. And right around that time, he was staying at the hotel that the terrorists took over and burnt down and everything like that. So he was like, he stopped getting into the Hollywood biz. The third person that was going to finance it was caught in a Ponzi scheme for Hollywood. They said that they got all this money from a financer over there. And then suddenly, like a year later, they're like headlines being like, these people don't have any money. This is a whole Ponzi scheme. And I was like, holy crap. So the person that I was optioning to at the time was Paul Coy Allen. Very nice guy. We got a bunch of projects in the works currently. But he was like, I don't know where I'm finding these people. I was like, well, please stop finding these people. And suddenly a woman comes out of the woodwork who had done like Hallmark films. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I want to option it. The script is called The Last Story of David Allen, by the way. She was like, I want to option it. And I was like, okay, like, let me give you a chance and see what you can do. And so she options it. And within a year, she's involved in a skiing accident, which breaks half the bones in her body. She's on a hospital bed, but the director that she found was like, she can't do it right now. I would like to take it over. And I was like, you know what? Fantastic. But let me talk to her first to make sure that you're not just scheming this whole system, right? So I talked to her and she's like, yes, I'm broken. I can't do this. And I was like, okay, so I'm just going to give it to the director, whose name is Justin Gullett. And Justin is a very nice guy, but I think he was similar to Paul, just trying to make a movie and not realizing how complicated this industry really is. And like, to make a movie requires 200 people and a miracle, right? Like, one person with a dream, but then 200 people that need to be paid and everything to work out perfectly. So Justin takes it over. This is like 12 years ago. And just is building funds and whatnot. But him and I are currently like both going through life changes, parents dying, getting married, getting divorced, everything going kind of ups and downs. And finally, everything comes into place in 2017, I believe it was. And you're going to be able to fact check this too, because we go, we're going to do it. It's going to happen. It's September. October 2017 is like, everybody is on deck. Pre-production is done. The movie's going to be filmed in Puerto Rico. 2 weeks before it's supposed to start shooting, Hurricane Maria hits the island, wipes out everything, right? What people don't realize is that after Hurricane Maria hits Puerto Rico and everything goes wrong, Puerto Ricans are besieged by earthquakes, like 50 earthquakes a day, to the point that nobody will insure any production on the island, including like Disney's getting off of it. So everything is kind of wiped at that point. And then at this point, I'm looking at Justin. I was like, how? Justin hasn't, the reason why I trust Justin in the whole matter is that Justin has not done one production. So, like, he's like, Last Story of David Allen is the first film I'm going to direct. This is going to be it. And I'm like, I believe you, because you haven't like put it on the back burner yet, you know. But this is getting kind of ridiculous, because up until this point, I'm just getting $500 for the option to rent it, right? Like, no money whatsoever, just kind of put in the pocket. Not that in the scheme of things, I wrote it over a weekend, so I'm making $1,000 a year off of it for 6 month options. Okay, like, it's okay money, you know, like, but then it wasn't until about 2020 that I realized, similar to like us getting into UCLA and everything, that I know nothing about the industry. I sold my first script after writing in a weekend, thinking I'm a genius. I know nothing. And after 12 years, it's time to admit it to myself. And so I start doing research, and going to UCLA and the professional screenwriting program, admitting fault, admitting that I know nothing. And then suddenly I got an entertainment lawyer, and she negotiates with these people that were paying me $500 for 6 months and gets me a five-figure deal, where I'm like, where the hell? Like, obviously I'm an idiot. So if anybody is listening for advice, entertainment lawyers, absolutely, when you start working with contracts, because they will go to bat for you. As long as there's all different kinds of entertainment lawyers, much like there's all different kinds of clients for entertainment lawyers. So you have to have a good partnership. They have to learn what you're into, and you have to learn what you want out of your lawyer. And really what I wanted was a bulldog, because I don't like the subject of money whatsoever. And I just want people to pay me what I'm worth and tell me what I'm worth, really. Where an entertainment lawyer, she was like, I could get you this, I could get you that. The biggest thing we wanted was reversion of rights, because meaning that when they purchase the script, but if they don't make the movie within a certain time period, I get the rights back. Mm-hmm. And then they get, if the movie is made, they get paid, right, as well. But it's always good, because another thing that I learned along the way is that producers, when they go to the PGA, when they get mentorship, producers are told, get a portfolio, get at least like 20 projects in your briefcase. So when you go into these pitch meetings, you have like five that you could just pitch right off the bat. They want to make the movie, sure, but in the same instance, they need that briefcase full of projects. So if you sell your movie to them, there's a good chance that that movie's just going to be lost, shelved, briefcase, put in the gutter, whatnot. So you want the reversion of rights, most importantly, so eventually you could get the rights back and sell it to whoever you want. Fast forward to UCLA professional screenwriting program. We write two scripts in there. You helped me out with doing the bank robbery script, which everybody was like, nobody wants a bank robbery movie. And I was like, I got an idea. And ended up writing that movie and optioning that one, to which even like last night, still there, the text that I got last night was, how much do you want for it? And now I have to go and try and figure out what I'm worth, because I'm still in my head like a $500 option writer. So have to go to the people and whatnot. Yeah, it's kind of like I would say like the fourth most exciting like screenplay conversation that I've had. But I will say that I just was in a classroom with a man who was one of the writers on Uncharted and everything. Because currently I'm getting my master's because I want to teach screenwriting. One of my favorite things about the UCLA program was how we got together every week and after reading everybody's scripts for the week and giving notes and hearing it out loud. And that to me is priceless. And that to me is also what I love about like the writer community, of everybody helping each other out. I like to give notes to people that can take notes. You know, it's very uncomfortable when somebody's like, I don't like that idea. And it's like, well, then don't do it. Like, I'm just giving you everything under the sun. Hopefully one day I can be a professor of screenwriting.
That's awesome. Where do you take the master degree classes?
Stevens College. I Googled the top 10 screenwriting programs in the country. I took out the New York ones because I don't want to live in New York. I appreciate everybody that lives in New York. I love to visit New York City. It's way too much concrete for me. Columbia University was like a four-year program that costed $250,000. I was like, I'm not interested. And
education is very expensive NYU. In America.
Yes. And you don't get much help. And then the help that you do get just is even more expensive than the education in itself, you know? And I'm 41 years old. If I take out student loans now, you know, I'm paying that until I'm on my deathbed, really. And so there was one school in North Carolina. It seemed kind of out of the way, where then I just applied to all the California schools. And Stevens College called me. They're like, we're going to set up an interview with you. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize that you had to interview for grad school. You know, like I didn't realize that that was part of the steps. I still don't. But they interviewed and the dean called me up, Dr. Roseanne Welch. And she was like, I just want to get a feel for who you are. And I was like, OK. So we talked and I told her, you know, I've had success in the screenwriting field. Nothing made, but at least I sold things. I was like, but my main passion is I want to combine being a teacher and also screenwriting. So I would hope to be a professor one day. And she was like, actually, funny enough, we've gone down similar paths. She's from Berea, which is a suburb of Cleveland where I live. And she's like, she wrote on things like Touched by an Angel. And she's like, I eventually wanted to teach. And so I got into this field. And so she's like, I feel like you and I share them those thoughts. And I was like, fantastic. It's all karma, you know. And and then she revealed to me that Stevens College is an all-women's college. I was like, wait, what? And she was like, yeah. She's like, did you not know that? And I was like, no. I was like, I'm almost a hypocrite because I was just talking about how I love research, but I didn't do any, it was just one of the top 10 programs. And so I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I guess I overlooked that. And she was like, no, no, no. She's like, when it comes to the grad school portion, we can't be as exclusionary. So she was like, so I would like to invite you, but you have to realize that it's an all women's course and whatnot. And I was like, okay. I start getting acceptances back from like UCLA, USC, and everything. And I'm looking at like the prices of what it's going to take for UCLA and USC. You have to move there. You have to be there. Stevens mm-hmm. College and Emerson in Boston, which I love Boston as a city, are low residency, which was kind of becoming more of my feel when I was looking at everything. But I couldn't shake the fact that if I was going to go to an all-women's college, if I was going to be accepted to an all-women's college, I was going to get an education like none of my peers, right? I was going to be a man getting everything through the female gaze, and could I pass that up? So I went back and forth with the dean, and I was like, if you can, I'm having some imposter syndrome, as I'm rife to do. I was like, if you can convince me that I'm not stealing the place of a woman, I was like, I would be happy to join you. And I was like, and then also, plus, if all the women that I'm going to be surrounded by believe that they're going to an all-women's college because they don't like, they're uncomfortable around people like me, let them know I'm coming. And, you know, if they have problems, like, I will gladly step away. And so it came to be that she reassured me it was going to be the largest cohort that they had with 24 people. And eventually, there's a professor from Stevens, an acting professor who's also male. I'm one of four in the program. But as we all sat around, the low residency means that you get to do a majority of it from your hometown, and then you can fly out to LA for the first week of every semester. We have all of our courses at the Jim Henson Studios. So you get to sit around Jim Henson's, like, you know, conference mm-hmm. table with his mural behind him. Oh, it's fantastic. But we like look around, and the first day, like, one of the women were like, how does it feel to be the minority? Great. And then another, I've come to learn that she did go around and she did make sure that everybody was comfortable, that me and John and a guy named Mark and a guy named Kurt were going to be there. And I was like, apparently you said yes, because we're all here. And they're like, yeah, but if Harvey Weinstein comes up or whatnot, we all just kind of sit down, you know, like fold our hands and put our heads down and
pray.
Yeah. And not express our opinions whatsoever. And obviously they'd be negative. Everything that I'm learning in this program that I didn't know before, like I didn't know that in the silent film era, 50% of all the scripts were written by women. I didn't realize that during the silent film era of Hollywood, it was pretty much the circus, right? It wasn't making a whole lot of money. Everybody can do it. One of the first films of all time, the lead star in it was an African-American woman. It wasn't until the 1930s where Wall Street went, oh, we could make money in Hollywood, that everybody came in and then pretty much it became a white man's game, right? So it's amazing to learn these things and to learn about the Mae Wests and the Bess Merediths of the world, the Lewis Webbers, and not so, pay so much close attention to what we all kind of know just being cinephiles. You know, like, we know about the Alfred Hitchcocks. We know about the Louis B. Mayers and Irving Thalberg. Like, we know all of them. And the Herman Mankiewicz, we know them because we grew up with them. So it's all these people kind of in the shadows who were there, who were doing amazing things. Bess Meredith is the first screenwriter to win 2 Academy Awards for writing. I never heard about her in my life until I had to research her for a semester. So it's all good. And then, of course, my second semester research project is Robert Riskin. So I get a mail and I was like, well, I guess I'll research him. But he was in Frank Capra's shadow for most of his life. But he is quickly becoming one of my favorite writers of all time, because if anything, how I evolved as a writer was I always wanted to retire into politics, but I don't like public speaking. That hurts, you know, the thing. But I was like, oh, if I write my screenplays with a political angle, and this happened at UCLA, this happened with Six Banks and Bakersfield, because Six Banks and Bakersfield is all about how if you're poor, nobody cares. You know, like if you're poor, whether you're Democrat or Republican, everybody's in the same shit pool at the bottom, right? It's a bank robbery script. You don't know how much money they stole, because really all it's saying is everybody that's poor doesn't even have retirement to look forward to. So they're just stealing to put things away in an investment account to have a retirement. And so there's a lot of that political intrigue into it. And the script that I just wrote for Stevens College is all about how there's so many men serial killers out there killing sex workers, because nobody cares if a sex worker dies, which I found quite sad, you know, like that they're human beings too. So, and then the next script, the next script that I have is all kind of about the prison system and whatnot. So I'm finding different ways to kind of curtail my writing to actually say something so that my political messages can still get out there, regardless whether I can stand in front of a podium and talk to a crowd of people.
You can always write speeches in your screenplays as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what Robert Riskin was doing. Robert Riskin did, he's most famous for It Happened One Night, which won the top 6 awards at the Academy Awards, I think in 1934. But what he did with like Meet John Doe is he talked for like the working man. He was a humanist, you know, he was in charge of the OWI during World War II and everything. But essentially, he was talking for people that he was just punching up at the rich, you know, which I really appreciate.
Let's go back to your the last story of David Allen, because there is a lot of things that I want to ask. So first of all, I think by just listening what you said, I think it's a great idea to write a screenplay about that screenplay, how the story of that screenplay, because there is so many things. It could be like a horror film, or like a Paranormal Activity. You know, like even when I'm talking to you right now, your screen is glitching with some random images that like kind of freak me out a little bit. So I feel like there is something with that screenplay. I feel there is something with that screenplay. That's insane. I never heard a story like that about it's just straight paranormal. I'm going to tell my friend about that. He put him on the paranormal podcast. But yeah, like you're saying it's like, it's okay. You know, this happened, that happened. And then like, I'm like, my brain is like, what? It's just bomb after bomb after bomb.
You feel like you have to like numb yourself to it. And that's what I've always kind of told, because obviously I'm dating and everything, and ladies will be laying in bed and like Hollywood calls because you guys are 3 hours behind me. So suddenly it's 9 o'clock at night and somebody has exciting news. It's midnight over here. And so for a while, my girlfriends would be getting excited. They're like, oh, is this it? Is this going to happen? And I was like, no, like, you have to kind of just take a back seat, because if you get very invested, well, in my path of things, if I invested myself fully, I would be bipolar, right? Like there's no way that I can ride these waves of ups and downs and being almost there and then being taken away. But I don't think it's unique to my situation. You hear about movies all the time taking 20 years to actually happen. I can't imagine, like, I would love for James Cameron to, you know, maybe hang up the Avatar for a year and come out with an autobiography of probably all the stuff. The man waits for technology to be invented in order to do his movies. You have no idea if that technology is going to be invented, or, you know, him taking trips down the Titanic. Like, he has to have like one of the most interesting stories of a filmmaker out there with everything that he is doing. But little old me with like a, I think Last Ray David Allen is a $5 million budget. That little movie, you know, like, who knows? I have no idea how many people out there have either praised or cursed my name because the project, you know? So it'll be interesting. Hopefully, September 1st, if we're going to put out Good Karma, September 1st is like the new production date.
All right. I'll check on with that September 1st. I wrote it down.
Or we're going to... A new sad sob story of, and it's in New Orleans. Nolens is the new place that it's going to be set.
Oh, that's a perfect place for that. I heard a lot of paranormal stories from there.
oh shit! Yeah,
yeah. Well, speaking of technology, you mentioned James Cameron. Since we graduated, so to speak, from the UCLA program. There's a lot of thing happened, and particularly artificial intelligence taking over Hollywood. What are your take on it? What do you think about AI writing screenplays? Because right before this conversation, I just typed, write a documentary screenplay about Michael Jackson. And it wrote me the entire treatment with like all the points that most of the people would put in the movie when they write a screenplay. What do you think about it? are you using it? Have you tried any apps? I'm curious.
I have not yet. My day job is I'm a before and after school teacher. I haven't been able to have any kids of my own, but so I borrow other people's kids and then send them back when they're tired. It's, you know, perfect arrangement. But I use ChatGPT, so trying to teach them about currency and investing and stuff like that, I would be like, tell me about the stock market as if I was 10 years old, and then I can look at that and then deliver that to the kids and start figuring out how to address it. As far as AI goes, I mean, I don't want to catastrophize anything, but I think we're all screwed. And it's not so much as AI that's going to be our essential problem. It's going to be the people in charge finding ways to make their lives cheaper, right? Like their bottom line cheaper. We've seen it, and it's not new. As much as AI is new, tell me a company that you can call now where you're not being greeted by a robot, right? Like if anything, if I would like the government to do anything, it would be to give these companies tax breaks in order to hire more humans. Like that's the essential answer, is helping them with their way overblown pocketbooks to hire real people. But that's not necessarily going to happen. So looking at AI, it's going to be one of those things where us who love real things are going to search out the real things. It's kind of like the people that really want organic carrots will search out organic carrots, but for the most part the market is going to be anything produced with chemicals, and AI is going to be what produces the most amount of work, and we're going to still go to that art hall to be like, oh my gosh, everybody that worked on this was a real person. I love the fact that Nolan did Oppenheimer without any CGI, but that we might look at that as like the last bastion, you know, of the people that... I'd be surprised if Nolan's Oppenheimer isn't the most... isn't the highest box office of no CGI movies for the rest of time. You know, like, I can't imagine somebody else is going to come out and say, this is all... For a movie that would probably require effects, you know, obviously, if Celine Song comes out with another Past Lives, she can't be like, there's no CGI in this movie, because we'd be like, well, it's a love story. But like a movie that you would think requires effects, I think Oppenheimer is probably going to be the last movie that is promoted as all practical, that makes as much money as that did.
There's a few things I want to mention about it. First of all, the Oppenheimer actually... Even though the actual movie is shot with no effects, but they use a lot of technologies to film the movie. Even the camera that's the IMAX, it's pretty much like fairly new technology, and it has a highest resolution than like some of the digital cameras. And for the lights, to do the lights for that sequence with the bomb when they're testing it, they created the whole, like a wireless network using some network devices to connect all the lights to like monitor them. So they still were using the technology to like to help to make the movie, but not the technology to put on the screen. And another thing about the VFX for the movies is that they have life. They have a shelf life, so to speak. After 10 years, if you watch a movie that is made right now with the state-of-the-art VFX, after 10 years, it's going to look a little cheesy because our eye is going to get adapted to it. And that's what Noel knows. Yeah. And that's why he doesn't make them with VFX, because he wants to have his films like a longer shelf life. Because when you watch like Casablanca, you're still enjoying it because there is no CGI in it.
That's what I always talk about when it comes to Steven Spielberg, mm-hmm. is where like Steven Spielberg back in the day used either like an amalgamation of like practical effects and visual effects. And so Jurassic Park is still amazing. Where then I think he started going more CGI, and Ready Player One, not as good, you know? And that saddens me about one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, is that I think he went more CGI and now his stuff is getting dated like the rest of them.
Well, I think he does a bunch of movies for the mainstream audience, but then he does like one nice personal film like The Fabelmans. So he kind of like
West Side Story.
West Side Story, yeah. He kind of redeems himself in a sense. All right, let's talk about your novelist life. The dead life. When did you decide that you want to try writing a novel? Was it always in your mind, or something motivated you to write it and publish it?
Yeah, I think a lot of the novel writing was because I was powerless in the making of the movies. Because like I said, making movies requires a lot of people, and to write a novel requires just yourself and sitting in front of a desk. I have never written with pretty much the audience in mind. Like, I write for myself first and foremost. Everybody always says the first draft is for you and the second draft is for everybody else. And with novel writing, the whole book is for you. The editors will give suggestions, but in the same instance, you're writing from your viewpoint. And so it was, we get to bring up the kids again. We were at recess one day and the kids, I think Walking Dead was just becoming famous, and so the kids were knowing about zombies, and so then the kids had all these zombie questions like, why are there no dog zombies, and da da da. And so we just, as teachers, because we were all young at the time, we're all like 25 years old, we're just writing down all the questions that, you know, can zombies walk the ocean floor? Like, how much pressure can they stand? And so all these zombie questions, once I moved out to LA in 2014, I was all alone. I was away from family. And I made a friend in the character of Alex Jordan in The Dead Life. And I wrote the first six chapters when I first moved out there, which I'm just kind of analyzing myself now and realizing I started writing when I moved to a new city in fifth grade. And then obviously I found comfort there in that. And then I found comfort when I moved out to LA writing the book. Wrote the first six chapters and put it down because writing a novel is tedious and it's long and it takes forever. And so then I think I jumped onto the next project or whatnot. But when I moved home from LA, I looked at the six chapters and I was like, these are really good. Let me try and finish this book. I got a divorce. Like, I got married and divorced in the same year. I married a woman who was in love with somebody else.
Oh,
don't have to get into that. But so then, like 4 months later, I'm going through a divorce and I was like, I'm going to finish the novel. I'm just going to focus my energy on this and let the lawyers worry about the divorce. And so we did that and I got the book done. I put it out on Submittable and found the head publisher of Atmosphere Press graduated the same year as I did from Ohio University. So kind of kismet, just like finding the dean of Stevens College. Mm-hmm. He was like, I would like to publish this book for you. And so we worked out a deal where I got to keep all the rights just in case. And he was, I think, just starting out with his publishing company. And we published it. And I can't tell you that it went off the shelves and sold a million copies or anything like that. But it landed into the hands of producer Steven Schneider, mm-hmm. who pretty much is M. Night Shyamalan's producer. He does all the Paranormal Activities, Insidious. He's behind all of that. And he contacts me and he's like, I love The Dead Life. And I was like, you're one of probably 358 people that bought a novel of it, because when your numbers are that low, you know exactly what they are. And he was like, it sounds like a TV show to me, but The Dead Life is a prologue to that. He was like, so I need a second book. And I was like, oh, what? Okay. And he was like, are you thinking about writing a second book? And I was like, I'm actually thinking about writing two books. Lie. I was not thinking about writing a second book, but when a Hollywood producer calls you, you are available for anything, right? And so he was like, well, tell me what's going to happen. And so right on the spot, I pitched a second book, which the first book was all a metaphor for a teenage girl going through sexual assault. The second book is all going to be about bad parenting and depression. And then the third book is kind of my 21st century answer to Jaws, because it's all set in Ocean City, New Jersey, which is like one of it's like the capital tourist town of America. People come in for a week, they stay there, they leave for a week. So it's like the town in Jaws. And so what we're going to get to, pretty much the one critique that I loved that I got from The Dead Life was, they were like, it's a zombie book, but there's only one zombie. They're like, never in a story about zombies is it not Armageddon or the apocalypse or a horde of zombies coming in. They're like, there's one zombie in this book. And I was like, I didn't even think about that. So I figured that at the end of the trilogy, then it could be like, if you want to know what happens next, watch any other thing that's out there. But the trilogy is kind of the prequel, the prologue to all of our knowledge on zombies currently today. Hmm. So it's like the prequel of zombies in general.
Yeah. And right now, I feel like the series is quite popular on bookshelves when you go to bookstores. You know, you'd be surprised, but in LA, there's a lot of book clubs and a lot of bookstores that I love to visit, because I love reading as well. And I think, like, right now, reading two or three books at the same time. One is audio, one is paper, and one is like kind of like back and forth manual, like a nonfiction thing.
Are you good with audiobooks?
Yeah. I found a way to listen to them, because there's a lot of driving happening in LA, and for me, it's a perfect time to listen. And especially if it's the same drive, then you kind of can focus more on the book. Because if it's like a new drive, like a new destination, it's a bit harder, because you have your mind is distracted more on driving. Yeah. But on the other hand, it makes you focus on the book more, because you're doing this mechanical activities with your hands and stuff, distracting your kind of like a monkey brain. And then your focused brain is completely on that book that you're reading. Yeah. And right now I'm actually reading The Making of Another Motion Picture by Tom Hanks. And he narrates it. That's the best part of some of the audiobooks, because the people like that narrate them as well.
And he got actors to come in to do that one as well, which was fun.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just kind of like in the beginning, mostly I can hear him. But there is some production. There's some music, some transitions, some more than the regular audiobook. I think you should record it too. You're The Dead Life. You can record it.
Oh my gosh. That would be the dream if I can. And because it's all stream of consciousness. So it's one person narrative. If I could find the right actress, we could put together the project and put in the sounds. Because I think the podcast world is starting to slowly influence audiobooks, because people now are so much more used to listening to people talk. And I mean, a lot of podcasts, this is great because this is very little scripting, you know, and just shooting from the cuff. But a lot of podcasts now are script writers and readers and whatnot. So the fact that audiobooks are bringing in sound design, you know, wind and the trees and everything, and people's footsteps walking, like you can lay in bed and kind of close your eyes and visualize what is going on. Like, I think it's one of the greatest things. Hopefully if the Dead Life became an audiobook, I think I would be more excited about that than I would anything else. Because in my mind, like, I always heard Alex's voice. And so to actually hear Alex's voice would be mind-blowing.
Yeah, now it's simpler than any other time in history to make it as an audio version. Yeah, that's crazy. You can even clone your voice using AI. You'll narrate a little bit and then it's kind of like copies it and then reads the entire book for you, so you don't have to struggle. Some authors already did that, I think.
Wait, it has to be on PDF, right? Is what I think I heard.
For that AI thing, well, you need to narrate it a little bit so that it catches your voice. And then it can be narrated, yeah. You insert text in somewhere, I don't know, some like prompt type of window that you do for like ChatGPT and stuff. I think the process is similar. Recently, I was listening to this interview that I was filming by Flavor Flav. It's a musician. One of his recent songs, he sang it, and then someone in Korea sang it as well in Korean. And then they used AI to mix their voice together. So then in Korean, you can listen to him singing in Korean, and it sounds exactly like him, but singing in Korean proficiently. It's insane. And there are some other languages
as well. It's great, yeah. There's a Instagram page that I follow called Exploring AI and the stuff that they're showing that they can do now, which one of them, I would love to show some of my students the films that I grew up on. But nowadays, it's weird that my students have been exposed to more things than I ever was because of TikTok, because of the radio, because of YouTube, like because porn is just immediately accessible. You know, like my students have matured way faster than they should. I think like we're ruining childhoods a little bit with how much we're giving them with screens. But in the same instance, the censorship across the school board is even harder. I remember when I graduated eighth grade, they showed us Forrest Gump, which Forrest Gump has drugs, it has sex, it has swearing, it has war, it has, it's across the board. Like you think about, it's a charming little story, but like that movie should not be shown probably in the school setting. But nowadays I can't show something like The Princess Bride because he says, "I want my father back, you son of a bitch." One line. And they're like, you can't do it, you know? So there's one AI feature that I saw coming up where they can digitally kind of how we always made fun of bad dubbing in movies on TV growing up, you know, when they would say like yippee-ki-yay motherfucker, and then they would like turn it to yippee-ki-yay jerk, you know, like, and but the mouse didn't match up or whatnot. They currently have AI to go across Bruce Willis's face and make the lips match the dubbing and then also dub the voice in Bruce Willis's, which I would love, because if they could ever give me a TV edited version of like The Goonies so I can show my kids how amazing that film was to grow up on, that's the AI I'm excited for, is to for that kind of stuff to work. But they, and the same instance with what you're talking about is the AI will also scan the faces and then make the lips move in the language that you want. So if you want to make it if you want to turn it into, you know, if you want to make Endgame in Spanish, they can go across everything and suddenly Iron Man is speaking hablo español. You know, like it's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And I had that experience. I have this Matrix experience when, you know, I was watching everything in Russian and it was dubbed mostly because like 70% of the films are from other countries. And then I came here and I started learning about filmmaking. I went to film school and I started watching films as a filmmaker. And I have this moment when I realized that I cannot watch Russian movies anymore, English-speaking movies or like other country-speaking movies in Russian anymore, because I can see the dubbing now. Because before I wasn't really paying attention to it as much because it's like a normal thing. Everyone is watching that and there's no really other alternatives. And if you want to watch a movie in another language with subtitles, it kind of feels like, I have to struggle. I have to like, you know, read and stuff, because you go to movies to watch, not to read. And then, then I just couldn't watch any more the dub movies. So it was a strange experience.
I will say that I love watching subtitled movies on the treadmill. Because like you're saying about sitting in traffic and listening to audiobooks, it's the same thing where because my right brain is watching the film and my left brain is reading the subtitles, none of my brain is realizing that I am exerting maximum effort on my feet, you know? So it helps me to go like 45 minutes on the treadmill and not realize that I really have, you know? That. So I will recommend that. If you're going to watch foreign films now where you need subtitles, it's treadmill is the way to go.
Yeah, I agree.
Get some exercise too.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Oscars a little bit. I'm just curious about your opinion on the most recent Oscars. What do you think? I'm not going to lead to anything. I just want a raw opinion.
So I have an Oscars podcast called Spro and Lee Take on the Academy, where we will kind of, in hindsight, you know, go through the Oscars and just be like, did this person really deserve it? We will dive deep into 15 plus movies of the year to try and find like the hidden gem or whatnot. The Academy Awards was started as a union buster, right? They did it so like people wouldn't form the Writers Guild. And nowadays, the Academy Awards kind of feels like a political game to try and benefit some companies over others. It's just a weird... I love it. It's my favorite night of the year. Let me throw that out there. I love the Academy Awards, but I love the Academy Awards for the potential that it has as being the greatest award show in Hollywood of the country or whatnot. But what they're doing with it currently, I think, one, when they injected diversity, absolutely, thumbs up for that. But when they injected diversity, they didn't scrape the plaque of non-diversity out. They're just trying to cover up the racism, kind of the prejudice that they had already in there by injecting more. And it's not like these people are watching any more movies, considering the fact that my least favorite thing about the last Oscars was the top 60 awards, the top 60 nominations went to only like 13 films. The top 10 Best Picture nominees were pretty much nominated for every other award at the Academy Award. You only had to watch like 14 films in order to see what the Academy was putting up as the best films of the year. And were they? You know, you look at like the top 10 films and you're like, five of those don't have a chance in hell, right? There was, I think, my biggest snub. Everybody talked about Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig as being the biggest snubs. I think my biggest snubs is Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman for May, December. That was just watching those two in the bathroom scene of that movie reminded me of the feeling that I felt seeing Robert De Niro and Al Pacino at the cafe scene of the diner in Heat. I was like, those are two big powerhouses right there on my screen. And I am enjoying every second of this. That movie was deeply disturbing. I never want to watch it again. I was like, but the performances that they gave were by far some of the best performances of the year. So the fact that they weren't even nominated. And that's the other thing that I... now you got me on a rant. That's the other thing that I don't like about the Academy Awards and our looking at them is that we like to throw around the word snub. And this is why we did the podcast as Spro and Lee Take on the Academy, is because every publication will say the word snub to get the clicks, right? But to say the word snub, what you're really saying is somebody up there doesn't deserve it. But nobody really has the courage to say who they don't think deserves it because they might need that person for an interview down the line, right? When we say Margot Robbie was snubbed from Barbie, who are you saying in the top five doesn't deserve their nomination? Like, don't say that Margot Robbie was snubbed if you're not going to be able to say that Annette Bening did not deserve to be nominated for NIAID. You could delete that if you want to get Annette Bening on your podcast at some point. But like that's typically what we're saying. And I would say that Margot Robbie wasn't snubbed because Julianne Moore should have got the nom over Annette Bening from NIAID. What did you think about the Academy Awards?
Well, for me, there's a lot of things, but the main thing that I got really frustrated that it wasn't just snubbed, it was totally ignored. And it's the movie Perfect Days. I really enjoyed that movie in theater. It was one of my favorite movies along with Past Lives. Past Lives at least was nominated, but this one nobody even talked about on the news, and that shocked me because that movie should have more attention because this is the type of movie that doesn't get enough attention just from, you know, viewership, like mass viewership perspective. It's not promoted as much. It's not like pushed. And it has all the elements to win the Oscar. Like, I would really be happy if it won the Oscar for best picture or best directing, for sure. Because it's also innovative in a sense. It doesn't have a regular story structure, but you still enjoy watching it. And that's what surprised me about the movie.
And that's what the Academy should be doing. They should be holding up these films that did not get the big budget or the big box offices that were perfectly made, right? And then saying on the biggest stage, go watch Past Lives, go watch Perfect Days. You know, the one, I forget what year it was, but my favorite film of the year was Triangle of Sadness. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And not even like the Academy Awards publications were saying, like, they were saying, like, well, Triangle of Sadness has no chance to win. It's like the 10th of the top 10. And I was like, but it's like, promote it at least, like, make people go watch it because the message that it's delivering. Where talking about Barbie doesn't need any more promotion. You know, it was fun, I guess, you know, and if anything, it deserves the MTV Movie Awards and stuff like that. But like, the fact that all we talked about during the Academy Awards season was Barbie was heinous. And I get it, like, that was a popular pick. And what Ryan Gosling did at the Academy Awards was probably the best moment of the night. It was so fun with his I'm Just Ken. Everything about it is fun. Barbie was fun. But was it meticulously crafted? Did it tell us about ourselves? Like, I don't know. To me, it was camp. And it's an unpopular opinion to have. But in the same instance, I don't think the Academy Awards is for the popular audience. It's for the stuck-up cinephiles, which maybe I don't necessarily get along with as well. Mm-hmm. But we definitely need a high art show, and the Academy Awards should be that as far as film goes, in my opinion.
Feature films versus TV shows. Which one do you think is better as a job? And what do you think is the future of both?
Well, TV shows would be better as a job because it's longer, mm-hmm. right? Where movies are pretty much, as far as writers go, movies are like winning the lottery. You're going to get one check and it's going to be great. Where TV shows is a job. Like, you get to go into a writer's room, you get to meet, you get to network with a whole lot more people. Writer's room for a TV show is the way to go if you want to get into the industry. You have to go where the jobs are. That's where they say, go to LA. You know, Atlanta has a hot spot. Mm-hmm. New York has some. You could go out to Vancouver if you want, but you have to go where the jobs are as far as TV goes. Where with film and with like how my situation is in Cleveland, the other people are out there and I get to play dodgeball all day with kids. As far as like where the industry is going, there was a really good article in Harper's Magazine by Daniel Bessner called The Life and Death of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And really what that is describing is it's bleak. It's bleak all around. And it's not just bleak for the people at the bottom. It's bleak for the people at the top. Nobody is making money anymore. We all kind of evolved to this, to the streaming industry, where theaters are going down, but not... There's only so much you could do as streamers. There's only so many subscribers you can get to, right? Like, until people start going... Netflix is losing subscribers by the fistful. So like, the streaming agencies just all feel like one big bubble. And when Disney's not making money anymore, you know, like, we're in a world where we're going to have to evolve, and it's going to be interesting. I catastrophized before by saying like AI is going to screw everything up and whatnot. It's, you can't kill art, right? Art is not going to die. Let me put that out there, but it's going to be an interesting 2 years where we try to figure out how to make it all work. And as far as, you know, words of advice is just keep creating, keep, there's a wealth of things out there. I can't keep up with how many good shows people talk about, right? I watched one episode of Dickinson and people were like, you didn't finish it? And I was like, I will get to it. I got about six other shows to get to, which is how many hours of viewing? Yeah, that's how I would answer it. Get your paycheck through film. and do it through contests and everything. Austin Film Festival is accepting things right now. That's a good one to get into. Nichols Fellowship, if you haven't made, I think the cap is $25,000 in the industry. Get there. There's only about five screenwriting competitions that I have heard you should give a damn about, because the rest are feel like fundraisers for a company. But get it out there for the feature film, and then move out to try and get into a writer's room. And at the end of the day, writer's rooms, as long as they are filled with good people, are great places to be. Because if you want to be a writer, then you love writers like you.
The interesting thing about the TV shows and just the content in general on TV, like that is being streamed. I mean, content is a bad word. Movies and TV shows that are being streamed, I think the quality will always win. People always will want to watch the best show, the well-made show. They don't want to watch like a, you know, standard type of Netflix show. They want to watch something that is cool, that's interesting, that it, you know, emotional to them. So even if there's, we will have movies that written by AI or even made by AI, I think it's going to be like a subcategory, like, you know, like B movie or like something like that. And eventually you people hope. Get tired of it, because I have like this conversation before, but to make it short, the main point that I got from it is that I think that people will not be interested to watch movies made by AI for this reason. We care what other people do. We care what other people think, because we are the people. I mean, we are people. And AI is AI. It's a different species, so to speak, if you want to call it that way. So movies made by AI have the point of view of the AI, but not of the human being. So I don't think we're going to be connecting to those movies much, because why we should care what AI thinks? Because we should be care what other people think. Not in the sense like what other people think about you, but we care what people think, because we are the people. If that makes sense.
It does make sense, but I do want to challenge your thought on that with an analogy, right? We all know home cooking is the best cooking, mm-hmm. but a whole lot of people prefer to go to restaurants mm-hmm. nowadays. Mm-hmm. They don't want to put in the effort mm-hmm. to eat from scratch kitchens. And, you know, like, so I do wonder, because in the end of the day, it's not necessarily what we should do. It's more what is the easiest route, especially... I don't want to say, especially in this country, we kind of certainly take our shortcuts. Mm-hmm. And that's, I would love people to promote people to do what's best for our community. But I'm seeing more and more, and maybe I'm pessimistic, I'm seeing more and more people taking the shortcuts. Mm-hmm. And if you give the person an option, would you rather have a person write a movie about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles hunting Jack the Ripper in Whitehaven, written by a person and released in 2 years? Or would you rather AI just give it to you right now? I think people would choose that. I just want to watch it right now. Like, and then there's all those jobs out the window. So I think in the next 2 years, as they're renegotiating the writers' contracts and the directors' contracts and all the contracts in Hollywood, I think they really need to figure out a way to curb the immediate gratification that people will get through AI. Because that's like the biggest thing that I'm realizing nowadays as a culture, as a country, is delayed gratification. With Amazon delivering the thing that you're shopping for in 2 hours at your door, is a thing of the past. Like, and so how do you curb that?
Well, there's so many points I can mention, but it's going to be for another podcast. I guess I need to work on how to make the point shorter. But I guess the thing is that we don't really... Okay, let's take the let's take restaurants, or like, let's take content. Like, we have so much stuff being made on social media and stuff. There's so much of it, and it's made so fast that we don't really watch it. We just ignore it. But if there is something that we know people spend time doing it, they put their heart and soul, and so to speak, into it, then we want to connect to it. There's this... if you cite the AMC intro commercial by Nicole Kidman, there's this incredible feeling when you get when you sit in the theater. You want to connect to people. You want to connect to the movie, to the soul of it. But I feel like when you have the knowledge, I'm trying to come up with an analogy of something that is made by a machine, but I cannot come up with it now. But I don't know. There is something about human being perspective on the world versus the computer perspective, because ultimately we're not trying to become AI. We're trying to become the best human beings possible.
I mean, you could say, for like an analogy, photographs versus oil paintings, right? Like, or any kind of handmade mm-hmm. art. Would you rather have something that an artist made on your wall, or would you have something that was photographed and then filtered and then, and you know, designed for you, and then 10,000 people have it? Like, I would rather have original artwork on the wall, and I would hope that I hope that people choose your way of thinking, and because I love it. And but even like my best friend Lee, who does the podcast with me, they changed one thing about the movie theater experience. They stopped giving him paper tickets, and now he doesn't want to go to the movie mm-hmm. theaters anymore because he was saving paper tickets, you know. And it's like, you loved going to the theater. He was like, but now I don't have. It's like people that forget their Fitbit at home, and because their steps aren't being tracked, they're like, well, what's the point of walking now? And it's like,
yeah, I do get that feeling sometimes with my Apple Watch. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah. Yeah, I guess there is way too much to unpack for one episode, or even for two. It has to be like a whole conversation scheduled and organized to talk about it. But anyway, it was a really pleasure to talk to you. And is there anything else?
Oh, man.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we missed? Because we covered so many things. So there's so many follow-up questions that I want to ask you. But is there anything else you'd like to add that I forgot to mention this time? Something to promote, something to put the spotlight on?
So I realized that with the whole interview, there was a lot of like pessimistic when it comes to like the future of the industry and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But there is so much good out there, good product. I definitely would promote going to see things in the theater, going to see the things that you haven't heard about in the theater, as far as ingesting more and more content. Usually the things that you hear about are like the Disney films and whatnot. But look for those films that, like Past Lives, that just snuck through and will probably only be there for a week, but try and like go out and see those films. Because I don't think you would be disappointed. And as far as like personally mine goes, go pick up The Dead Life. If you're going to support an artist, I wouldn't support them through Amazon.com. Amazon takes like 80% of the proceeds from it. So, but there's so many other websites called Thrift Shop Books, A Books, which very much promote the artists and puts more money in their pocket for the art that you're taking or that you're subscribing to. So I would put that out there as far as that goes. You could find The Dead Life on all of those platforms and get ready for the sequel, Dead Inside, which this is the first time I'm actually telling the title. So there you go. And that is coming out early next year. And we'll try and get the trilogy under works, and hopefully Steven Schneider will come out and be like, great second book. He ruined me by saying he really liked the first book, because then I went inside my shell and said, the second book's going to suck and you're going to hate it. So it has taken a while to get the sequel out there. And then hopefully The Last Story of David Allen. If you want to follow me on Instagram, MatthewSprosty.com, I will post on there that we have gone underway, or I will tell you the next phase of the curse and what happened. So New Orleans, strap on, because I'm bringing my cursed movie down to you.
Yeah, I want to hear that story when it happens. I see, maybe it's going to be part two at some point. Yeah. Unless you get stuck there.
I will sign on up and we can have like a short little 5 minutes, and I could be like, this just happened. Uh-huh. Oh my God. So
crazy. Yeah. All right. So now the final question of the interview, I ask everyone, if you were an extraterrestrial from a perfect world where everything is well and organized, and then you come to our world with all of its issues, what would be the one thing that you'd fix?
Oh, man. It's kind of like a trap question, isn't it? I subscribe to the humanistic Buddhism theory of just we're all people and we should not judge anybody else and not make strife for anybody else and just try to be at peace with ourselves. The one thing that I would, I mean, that's almost being solved in itself, where we all speak kind of like the same language with through our apps and whatnot. I recently traveled to Taiwan and was able through Google to speak to whoever I wanted because they spoke into my phone, it turned it into English. I spoke into my phone, it turned it into Cantonese. And so that is amazing. Like the whole Tower of Babel just crumbled. What would make this a perfect world is just understanding each other and figuring out what the real problems are. I think that would be like the ultimate thing is like the film Arrival, when they're saying communication is the ultimate, you know, tool that would solve the most things of just people being able to sit down and talk out their problems and figure out how to work together as a world and as a species instead of countries and territories and stuff like that, I believe.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And before I let you go, this is the question I ask for fun, and it's called Obsession of the Week. Something that you've been obsessed this week. It could be anything from, you know, a toilet paper brand to a movie or to, for me, for example, it's Dear Holmes subscription. It's like a mystery subscription where you get a clue every week and then you have to solve the mystery. And then after like 4 weeks, you get an answer, like the full explanation from Mr. Holmes. Is there something that you've been obsessed this week?
What I've been telling everybody is about a show called Warrior on Netflix. And it's by the man that did Banshee for Cinemax. And that was one of my father's favorite shows. Mm. And so I watched Banshee. It was only 4 seasons. And then I realized that the creator was coming out to do Warrior. And if you like martial arts and a little bit of sex with your violence, like that show is just... I'm watching it one episode a day because there's only 3 seasons. There's only 30 episodes.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming in today. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Rumi K Talks podcast. You can find the show notes at rumik.com. I'm your host, Konstantin Staradetsky. My producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. See ya.